This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The coup in the Soviet Union has failed. When we heard the news earlier today that Gorbachev was on his way back to Moscow, we called Robert Cullen for his assessment of why the coup failed and what lies ahead for the Soviet Union. Cullen writes about the Soviet Union for The New Yorker and The Atlantic, and he's the author of a forthcoming book on the crumbling of the Soviet Empire called Twilight of Empire. I asked him if he thinks the unsuccessful coup represents the last gasp of the hardliners.
I don't think that you can call it the last gasp of the hardliners. There remains the possibility that other hardliners who were not participants in this coup might at some time in the future find an opportunity to do something similar and perhaps try to do it more effectively. Don't forget that Gorbachev, in the most recent poll that I saw, had a 7% approval rating. If, as I suspect, he's going to now enter into a very difficult period where he gives away a great deal of authority to the republic governments and in a way that I think may be unwise, then the likelihood is that the Soviet Union is heading into a very chaotic period where the economy is not going to recover. And in those circumstances, a right-wing coup, a coup to restore order, is always at least a vague possibility. But I think it will be a while before the KGB and the security forces in general recover from the defeat that they apparently are suffering right now.
How much can we credit the failure of the coup to the power of the people, and how much of it do you think is just a sign of how badly managed the coup was?
I think that both are true. When I was in the Soviet Union in June talking to military officials about the possibility of a coup, I met with a general named Alexander Bajanov, who told me that there would have been a coup already if there were any social support for it. And I think he was correct in pointing out that you can't have a coup if the only people that support it are the army. Usually in a situation where a coup is sustained, it's because some elements in society are prepared to support it. And there were almost no elements in Soviet society prepared to support this one. I think that it was badly planned and that the military acted out of desperation as much as anything else, not out of conviction that they had a coup plan that would work. I think they felt that the only thing that they could do to preserve their own institutions and their own power in the society was to roll the dice and see what happened.
It looks like Gorbachev is returning to power. Do you think he's going to stay in power?
I would imagine that he'll probably be in office at least until next year, when there presumably will be elections for president of the Soviet Union. At the moment, it remains to be seen whether he could be elected president, but I think that he will at least retain power until those elections. Now, whether he will have real power remains to be seen as well. Clearly, he owes his job and maybe his life to Boris Yeltsin, and I don't think that Yeltsin is going to forget about that, and I think that Yeltsin is going to take advantage of the opportunity that he now has to consolidate a great deal of power in the office of the Russian presidency and to emasculate the president of the Soviet Union to the degree that he feels is necessary. So I am not sure how much authority Gorbachev will have, particularly inside the country. I think that Yeltsin may find that he prefers to have Gorbachev acting as a front man for the country and using his international prestige to help arrange economic assistance and so forth. But I can't imagine that Gorbachev will be able to tell Yeltsin much of anything as far as what he wants Yeltsin to do internally.
Are there any ways that you think Gorbachev's position will have been strengthened by the failed coup, in the sense that, you know, the popular support rallied around him for the first time in a really long time?
Popular support rallied around him, but I think that it really rallied around the concept of democracy and constitutional government much more than around Gorbachev personally. Clearly, I think that now people will realize a little bit more clearly the difficult position Gorbachev has been in over the last few years, trying to appease these hardliners and at the same time continue to move forward with reforms. And I think they may appreciate more the real risks that he faced as he pushed his reform programs. So it may be that there will be some more sympathy for the difficult position he's been in and the difficulties that any individual would have faced in his position. But I can't imagine that suddenly people who are standing in line for bread are going to start thinking Gorbachev is a great man.
Do you think the failed coup will bring new opportunities for Soviet democracy?
Yes, I do. First of all, I think that it probably means that there will no longer be much likelihood that the Soviets will hold on to the republics that are determined to break away. The fact that the military could not enforce its will in Moscow suggests that the time for enforced decision-making is over, and that any further arrangements will have to be dependent to some degree on the consent of the people involved, and those republics, particularly in the Baltic and the Transcaucasus and Moldavia, are not likely to give their consent to anything except independence. And I imagine that given Yeltsin's position that if they really want to be independent, they should be allowed to be independent, that they will somehow, someday, soon, get that independence. Once that national issue is settled to some degree by consent, then I think that the likelihood of democracy putting down deeper roots is all the better, because the real disadvantage to democracy, insofar as the Russians have been concerned, I think, was this idea that, correctly speaking, that the democracy entailed the breakup of the Soviet Union. Now I think they've come to the point where, under Yeltsin's leadership, they can accept that, and therefore I think they're much more likely to concentrate on building a democratic market economy in Russia and to let the republics that don't want to stay in the Soviet Union leave.
So in some ways, the Soviet society might be more open now that the coup has failed. On the other hand, I wonder if they'll be more closing down in some respects. For instance, I could see the government being more fearful about another coup and trying to protect itself against the KGB or the military.
Well, I think that the only real protection against the military, it might be possible to dismantle to some degree the KGB, but I don't think that, and I certainly think the size of the Russian army, the Soviet army, will diminish, because the republics are not going to support a huge army of the type that the Soviet Union now has. I think that, apart from that, the real protection that any government has against a coup by the people who hold armed power in their hands is tradition, respect for constitutional institutions, and so on. And I think that the likelihood is that the Soviets have established, in effect, a new tradition here, and that it will be a long time before the army thinks about taking power into its own hands again.
You know, in trying to follow everything that's happened for the past couple of days, you can't help but think about the really strange relationship that Gorbachev and Yeltsin seem to have. You know, Gorbachev kind of banished Yeltsin just a few years ago, and then there was Yeltsin supporting Gorbachev. And what do you think the relationship's going to be like now?
I don't think it will be a friendly one, although they're both capable of putting up a pretense of friendship if their political interests require it. I think that Gorbachev and Yeltsin basically dislike each other. Gorbachev sees Yeltsin as an upstart usurper, a person who refused to play along the lines of Gorbachev's plan, even though Gorbachev was the one who brought him to Moscow, and presumably thinks that Yeltsin should have been more loyal to him. Yeltsin, I think, sees Gorbachev as a part of the old order that he has a historical mission to change. And I don't think that their personal chemistry is particularly warm. On the other hand, they've shown in the past that they can be at each other's throats one month, and then a few months later pretend that that never happened, and that for the sake of their own individual political interests, they can cooperate. So I would imagine that they will, for at least a time, get along fine, at least on the surface.
My guest is journalist Robert Cullen, the author of a forthcoming book on the crumbling of the Soviet Empire. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Cullen, and he writes about the Soviet Union for The New Yorker and The Atlantic, and he's the author of a forthcoming book on the crumbling of the Soviet Empire called Twilight of Empire. What do you think of how President Bush handled himself during the crisis?
I imagine that it's hard to fault success, and Bush pretty much did what you would hope a president would do, that is to stake out a strong position, morally speaking, and not promise or threaten intervention. I think that it would have been a hollow threat, and if the promise had been made and then not kept, we would have borne some responsibility for what happened, and as we did, I think, in Eastern Europe in 1956. So I suspect that the president handled this particular aspect fairly well. As to how he's handled the Soviet-American relationship during the time he's been president, that's another question.
Okay, let me ask you that question.
Well, I personally think that Bush, particularly during the first year and a half of his presidency, wasted an opportunity to begin developing normal economic relations with the Soviet Union because he was afraid of the reaction by conservative Republicans. When he took office, Gorbachev had already done most of the things in the foreign policy area that the Reagan administration had said they would like to see before they really thought the Soviet Union had changed. Then Bush said that he was not prepared to begin normalizing economic relations unless the Soviets passed a new immigration law that codified their liberal immigration policies that had already begun under Gorbachev. Well, that wasn't in the law. The Jackson-Vanik Amendment, which was the law governing U.S.-Soviet trade relations, didn't require the Soviets to pass a law. In effect, Bush moved the goalpost back on Gorbachev and kept them there for another 2 years. And while it's impossible to say that better economic relations with the West would have strengthened Gorbachev, helped the Soviet economy, and prevented the coup attempt, it certainly wouldn't have hurt him.
It looks now that both Gorbachev and Yeltsin really owe something to Bush because of the way he backed them. How do you think that that favor might be repaid, or what do you think the United States might ask of them in return?
Well, I think that both Gorbachev and Yeltsin are appreciative, certainly, of not only what Bush did, but what the Western world did. I think that everybody will calculate, and probably correctly, that the people who initiated the coup wanted to pull it off in such a way as not to rupture their ties with the rest of the world. That's presumably why they tried to do it nonviolently. And the fact that the West immediately responded by saying that those ties will be ruptured regardless of how you handle a coup, as long as it's an unconstitutional and illegitimate government, I think had a role in the dissolution of the coup. Not a great role, but a role. And I think that the thing that the West will want in return is more of what has already been going on, and that is Soviet cooperation in addressing multinational problems, such as the Middle East or the Persian Gulf or the environment and so on. I don't think that there will be any payment required, but I do think that President Bush will be quite surprised if Yeltsin or Gorbachev or both of them don't continue to try to play a constructive role in the United Nations and in the solution to multinational problems.
Do you think there'll be pressure on the United States not to grant most favored nation status to the Soviet Union?
Well, I would assume that if Gorbachev resumes the presidency, as he appears to be about to do, that the trade agreement which the president sent to Congress at the beginning of August will be approved and that the Soviets will get their most favored nation status. The interesting question will be whether the West will be more disposed now to listen to Yeltsin's and Gorbachev's appeals for substantial direct aid as opposed to just normalized tariffs. I'm not sure what the response will be, but I suspect that there will be some who will say that we ought to make sure that we do what we can now that the hardliners have been vanquished and there doesn't seem to be any doubt about the bona fides of Gorbachev's and Yeltsin's devotion to democracy, that we ought to do what we can to try to help them get the economy on the move again and stabilize the country. On the other hand, there isn't a lot of cash around to do that with, and there are still a good argument to be made that it would be a waste of money to simply give them a big infusion of cash until they have finished the difficult job of restructuring the economy and preparing it to make good use of Western assistance.
So getting back to something that you just said, you see the lack of violence as a weapon used by the members of the coup. You see that as an indication that they wanted Western relations with the Soviet Union to continue.
That is the thing that I can't figure out. It would have been possible, I would think, for them to have had a couple of commando squads kill Gorbachev and kill Yeltsin at the beginning of the coup and attempt to decapitate the resistance. And I'm sure that in light of what's happened, there are a lot of coup supporters who wish that that's what they had done. I think the fact that they didn't do it suggests either that they completely miscalculated the political situation and thought that just by declaring a coup that the an alienated populace would flock to their support, or that they wanted a coup but they didn't want to burn their bridges with the rest of the world, and therefore they tried to have it as nonviolently as possible to give it a veneer of constitutionality by having Inayev be the one to succeed Gorbachev and so forth. It was clearly miscalculated, but why exactly they didn't start off by disposing of the people who could rally opposition to the coup, I can only assume it's because they did not want to rupture completely their relations with the rest of the world.
You know, there was something almost funny about the lack of imagination showed by the leaders of the coup, in the language that they used, in falling back on the old, oh, he's sick. He's sick, so we had to replace him. And then when a couple of the leaders of the coup were out, it was like, well, they have an unnamed illness or an unnamed
right.
condition. They couldn't even come up with they couldn't even come up with a name for the condition that was disabling them.
Right. Yeah, well, I guess the only explanation for it is that these are men in their 60s who spent the first 60 years of their lives in a Stalinist Brezhnevist system, and maybe they're a little too old to have learned completely. I don't know. I would have expected more of them. Certainly the fact that the KGB in recent years has started to try to polish its image in the Soviet media suggests that they were not entirely unsophisticated. But you're right, the coup smacked of the sort of old-fashioned Soviet big lie tactics. Maybe that's the only way you can run a coup in the Soviet Union, is to just lie your way into it and try to brazen it out. But it certainly didn't persuade anybody that these people offered anything but a return to the past.
The head of the KGB was one of the people behind the coup. What do you think is going to happen with the KGB now?
Well, it's a very difficult thing to do, to dismantle a security operation like the KGB, and I don't think that Yeltsin or anybody else really wants to dismantle it completely. No modern government, and they look to the United States and other Western powers as their models, gets along without an internal security police and an external intelligence agency, and I think that they believe that they should have both. The question is the security agency and is the intelligence apparatus loyal to the presidency and to the established constitutional powers? So my suspicion would be that they will try to replace Kruchkov and probably some of his deputies, insofar as they know who was involved in the coup plotting, but that to a large degree the apparatus will remain intact.
Do you believe at all in the theory that's circulating in some quarters that Gorbachev was in on the coup?
Well, no. The most cogent reason against that is that if he were in on the coup, that would mean that somehow he had persuaded Kruchkov and Yazov and Yanayev and all these people to sacrifice themselves in order to strengthen his position. And there's no indication that he could or would do that. They, after all, have been opposed to a lot of what he's been trying to do for at least a year, and he hasn't been able to even get them to resign. Now you're asked to believe that he somehow persuaded them to expose themselves to criminal charges, and I just don't find that credible. The big question remains as to why the coup failed to remove Yeltsin as a threat from the beginning, and I really don't know the answer to that, except that the Soviet military didn't really understand what was required to stage a coup in Vilnius in January. And it could be that it's just hard-headed enough not to have learned how to anticipate the popular response to a coup and allowed Yeltsin, through incompetence, to remain a threat to them.
What do you think is going to happen to the leaders of the coup?
It's very, very difficult to guess. There's a lot of sentiment, obviously, now in the Russian parliament to try them for state crimes, and it may well be that some of them will be tried. I think, though, that there will be a stronger sentiment to try to put this behind both the Soviet and the Russian governments, and that in that with that objective, they will try to reach some kind of a compromise where maybe the individuals all resign and give up any chance of ever retaining a powerful position again, but are not prosecuted. But I can't predict that.
Given before the coup that there was only a 7% support for Gorbachev and the Soviet population, what do you think the reaction is going to be to his return to the presidency?
I think there will be a general acceptance of his return to the presidency, assuming that he goes ahead and submits, either resigns or retires, or submits himself to a genuine election sometime in the near future. And I think that's planned for next year, and I believe that he certainly will respect those plans. I think that people will, from this time forward, be more prepared to give Gorbachev his due as the person who brought the Soviet Union from a communist, semi-totalitarian state to the verge of democracy, and not to be so critical of him now that they've seen the kind of opposition that he had to face to get them as far as they've gotten.
Well, I wish you a good trip back to the Soviet Union. I hope you get to go there soon.
Thanks.
And thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Robert Cullen is the author of a forthcoming book on the crumbling of the Soviet Empire called Twilight of Empire. It's scheduled to be published in October. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.